I'm Kathy Bosch, and I, in this workshop on fighting fair, we're going to cover some things in dealing with problem solving, conflict resolution, just plain good communication. Try to look at what does not help in communication. And instead of using the dichotomy of good, bad, right or wrong, I'd like to look at what's helpful and what's not helpful. I mean, that's the basic bottom line. Does it help? Doesn't it help? Doesn't matter, right or wrong, in somebody's opinion, does it help anything? And so we'll look at fighting fair. A couple of good resources. There's one that comes out of Peaceworks in Florida that's called Fighting Fair for Families, and it's great for even kids and to deal with. And they do a lot of materials for schools. Fran Schmidt and Ellis Friedman on Fighting Fair for Families. And that comes with a neat little poster as well on rules for fighting fair that we're going to get into. The Intimate Enemy is by George Bach, B-A-C-H, is a classic, How to Fight Fair in Love and Marriage. And then David Augsburger has a couple of good ones that are also have also been around a while. Caring Enough to Forgive, Caring Enough to Hear, Caring Enough to Confront is a third one that he has, which is not is out of the library right now. I just thought we might look at a couple of transparency, some cartoons. Here's Krabby Road. And I think when we think about fighting is a common experience. Everyone does it. I mean, we're going to be fighting now. We just need to know how to fight fair and not do dirty fighting. And here's Krabby Road saying, I learned everything I needed to know in kindergarten. Scream until you get your way. And that's how a good number of us learned how to fight. And in fact, we probably got our best lessons this way. Here's Dad walking along with a sweatshirt on saying, role model. And the kid is walking along beside saying, chip off the old block. We learn a lot about fighting from how we've grown up. And even though we may have been away from that situation for more years than we were in it, it's still pretty well ingrained unless we consciously make decisions to revise that message inside us. It's an automatic because we have lived it so long. I mean, I grew up in a household where fighting could be quite wild. And we lived on a farm. And, you know, there's nobody around to hear if you got into a fight or you yelled or you screamed. And if you got mad, you'd go out into the grove and pick up sticks and hit them against another tree and break them into little pieces. That had a good side, a helpful side of it, too, because if it was your turn to pick up the firewood for the wood cook stove, you had it already broken up. So sometimes, in some situations, it was helpful. Others, you know, living in a city, you don't have the wood lots, and you don't have the wood cook stoves, and it's not as necessary. But what did we really learn? One of the things I fight against is that my mother's way of fighting was just to clam up, and she wouldn't talk for a couple of hours. And you could plead and whatever, and it still didn't make it. And I have to learn not to fall into that pattern. Some of us fall into the category of Calvin and Hobbes cartoon. Calvin and Hobbes are walking in the woods, and Calvin, you have to remember that he's about a 7-year-old or so. Calvin is saying, nothing I do is my fault. My family is dysfunctional, and my parents won't empower me. Consequently, I'm not self-actualized. Good old Maslow statement, self-actualization. My behavior is addictive functioning in a disease process of toxic codependency. Now that's a mouthful for any age. I need holistic healing and wellness before I'll accept any responsibilities for my actions. And that's probably understandable by a lot of people. You know, I'm not going to accept responsibility for my actions. It's not my fault. If only you wouldn't. And we do a lot of you messages. What we talked about yesterday comes along Hobbes with his good reasoning, and he says one of us needs to stick his head in a bucket of ice water. And Calvin keeps on walking and says, I love the culture of victimhood. And there's a number of people who fit into this category. went to a workshop one time on dealing with difficult people. And I thought it was interesting that the presenter said at the end of his day, you know, the stuff that we've been learning will work on about 90% of the people you have to deal with. But to quote the instructor, there are about 10% of the population who will always be SOBs. Nothing is going to work. They know that if they give in the slightest, they lose, or they don't have the power. And not to have power is a terrible, horrible, very bad, no good thing. And so others live in the culture of victimhood. Nothing I do ever works out. Why should I bother trying? Oh, whatever you say, dear, oh, you're going to get the last word anyway, so why should I even bother? You know, that kind of dirty pool. Then you've got Lynn Johnson with her For Better or For Worse cartoon. And she has just given a punishment to her teenage son, and he's saying, this punishment is totally unfair. Mother says, it is not. Son says, it is. So she says, it is not. He says, it is. And mother says, it definitely is not. The teen yells, you don't understand. Mother yells, I do understand. And as I said before, Michael, I refuse to argue with you. She got caught. And a lot of us get caught. We're not going to, we say, we lay down the rule, I'm not going to argue, I'm not going to let this get to me, I'm not to go. And all of a sudden, we're, it is, it isn't, it is, it isn't, and we go back and forth in that kind of argument. We also have the Peanuts type of character. Peanuts is saying, Linus is saying, I don't like to face problems head on. And he continues, I think the best way to solve problems is to avoid them. And he goes on, this is a distinct philosophy of mine. No problem is so big or so complicated that it can't be run away from. And so we often, as we deal with problems or fighting, we respond in one of three ways. One is that we take flight, we run away, we fight back, or we give in. And we want to look at a fourth possibility, and that is, how do we deal with it? How do we work with it to find a resolution that can solve it? Here's another way that some people like to solve it. You know, things to do tomorrow, get up at the crack of dawn, stuff up the crack, go back to bed. That's another approach to running away. There's no problem so great that it can't be run away from. Just pretend it doesn't exist and you go away. No, there's no problem. No, I don't know, nothing's wrong. You know those kind of people? You have to deal with it. A lot of what we work with in communication really has to deal, and we can look at this whole conglomeration of balloons, and how we'll look at things will really depend upon some memories that we have, some attitudes, our values, our beliefs. What do I really believe? Everybody's out to get me. Oh, this will never work anyway, so why bother? What are some of your interests? What some strong feelings that you might have? Assumptions? Images, whether the past or present, expectations. What do I expect? I expect people to respect me. I expect, somebody else may say, I expect people to give in, because after all, I'm right. I have to be right, because if I'm not right, I'm wrong. And then that's a terrible, horrible, very bad, no good thing. Have any of you seen this children's book? It's in the bookstore by Judith Viorst. It's both in paperback and in hardback. Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Thing. And I remember when I first saw the book, which was when our kids had just gotten into teens, and my sister-in-law had the book with her, and I said, gee, that's one of the sad things about having your kids grow up. You lose track of all the good children's books that come out. And she said, I didn't buy this for Margaret, I bought it for myself. Because it talks about, you know, there will be days, it ends up in a sense, and there will be days like that. It just looks terrible, horrible. So our expectations, our assumptions, our past experiences, where we are, the physical environment around us, and the prejudices that we have. people older, younger, if they look like, you know, if you had a bad, I'm not going to go into psychoanalysis, but if you've had a bad relationship with a certain type of person, other people who resemble that person or who are in positions of power similar to that person, you'll automatically place the other expectations on them as a kind of prejudice. It doesn't have to be just about color or about ethnic background. It can be about past experiences. I saw someone at the village here the other day who reminded me of one of the ag agent that I worked with one summer when I was in between university years, and I worked as a 4-H club assistant. And this was a guy who could never admit that he had done anything wrong. We were going on a tour, 4-H tour, from farm to farm to farm, and he was driving, and he had a station wagon, and kids were sitting in the back. And I was sitting in the front, and just as we started off, I happened to look around and notice that the back door wasn't closed. And I said, "Stop. The back door isn't closed. The kids could fall out." And he stopped and he turned and he just spewed out a whole set of vindictives at me, including names that he should never have called anyone in front of kids like that at any time, let alone in front of a bunch of kids. Because I had, you know, the kids, I don't know whose fault it was, whether he needed to shut it, whether the kids should have shut it as they came in. I just was aware that something was wrong and we needed to correct it. I was ready to walk. You know, I wanted to take flight. So now anytime I see anybody who's very bald and only a ring of hair around here and is about that height, I sort of respond to past experiences and associations. Okay, let's look at the way some people communicate. Virginia Satir has done a lot of good work in communication and in self-esteem. And she talks about five basic ways in which people communicate, three of them that are on here. The placator, that's the person who's eager to please. And if you were to do a kind of impression of a placator, we can all give this a try. Placator is one who sits on the edge of the seat with sort of hands folded in front, sort of out in a pleading style, begging, you know, peace at any price. Eager to please, agree to anything, always apologizing, saying yes, to sacrifice themselves. They couldn't say no to save their soul, because if I say no, somebody may not love me, and I've got to be loved. Feels worthless, unsure, they're dependent. For example, they would be likely to say a lot, "Whatever you want, dear," or "I'm sorry, I didn't do it, I'm sorry. Can I get something for you, do anything for you?" Wanting to fill in. Now, there's always a time where we may want to serve another person. And there's nothing unhelpful about that. It's the balance. Are you constantly on the edge of your seat, waiting to jump off and be the servant? Blamer. We all know people fit into that category, I'm sure. They've often got their finger pointing out there at you, and they forget to realize that they've got three pointing back at themselves. But the finger out there, and it's shaking away. You can't accept blame. That would be another terrible, horrible, no good, very bad thing. Criticizes, nags, finds fault, acts disagreeably, hostile, controlling. And they're likely to say, "It's your fault. If it weren't for you, I'd be happier. You are so dumb." Lots of labels and lots of put-down kinds of responses. And that blamer is going to be one that stands up with hand on the hip, foot facing forward, and one holding back, and a finger out in front, if you wanted to get a kind of visual perspective on it. That's really probably an over expression of it, but you get the idea. The computer. That's the person who sits as if they've got a steel rod up their back, and their voice is very much in a monotone. They're just spewing out facts. They have no feelings. Super rational people. Appear calm, cool, composed, very reasonable, choose words carefully, deny their own feelings, will cite facts and statistics, just like a computer, to justify their opinion. An example might be, "I'm not upset. What you are doing is silly." Now, this is the way it's supposed to be. Of course I'm a knight. There's no other. I had a friend who, whenever I'd make a statement, would generally respond, "Who said so?" As if I had to have, three or four documentations and letters to prove the point that I was saying. Now, there's probably a very important place for that computer person in a work relationship where things need to be done, where responsibility needs to be taken, and information needs to be given and shared with the group. When that's used with all of, within other types of relationships, more social relationships, family relationships, where there's supposedly some democracy working there, it's not helpful. And that's,
can I interrupt just a second?
Sure.
On the placator part of it, one of the struggles I have, even in a preaching sense, is to try to make distinctions between what it means to be a Christian servant, mm-hmm. without falling into that trap of being a placator or a person who's just kind of totally run over. Mm-hmm. And there's a fine line in there, and I don't know if I always understand what that fine line is between servanthood and between kind of, denying yourself so much that you become a non-entity.
Mm-hmm. And that is, as I hear you say, that is a delicate balance. How do you still show your Christian concern for another person without being run over? Mm-hmm. Another illustration would be the pastor, for instance, mm-hmm. who is constantly running off to this person, that person, and is the handholder for everyone in the congregation and never sees his own family or her own family. That clergy family needs to belong to another congregation where another pastor can take care of them. But I think one of the best things that's happened in many congregations is to have trained Stevens ministers, or to develop a shepherding program where it doesn't fall just on the pastor to be this Christian servant, but that we all are servants. And we serve each other and not wait to be served, and that only can be served by one. For instance, some large churches will have other visitors who will call in nursing homes, if there's a lot of older people in nursing homes. And people in the nursing homes won't count it as a visit from the church because it's not the pastor. And yet, so many other people can fill in. I mean, there's still a finite number of hours for the pastor as there is for others in the congregation. 24 hours, no more, no less for anyone. So, to watch, where do we walk the line and not be taken advantage? Well, part of that is our own feeling of being the placator. We could talk about the victim. The placator may also take on the role of being the victim. I can't say no. Well, part of it may go back to what some of that early training. I've got to love everyone. I know somebody whose mother has taught him all along the way, everybody loves you. And that's been such a strong message that anywhere along the way, if somebody looks cross-eyed, the person dissolves, because that means someone doesn't love you. Well, not everybody even knows you. How could they possibly all love you? So we have to, in this sense, we have to recognize that as a Christian, as this child of God, this is one of our name tags that says, "I am lovable and capable." And I firmly believe that this is a gift that's given to us when we come into this world, a gift from our Creator that says, God doesn't make junk. I use this as at the bottom of a name tag that I use when I do educational courses, or on a pin-on name tag, whatever. And some years ago, when my husband and I were doing a marriage enrichment program for a group of older middle-aged people, when we weren't in that category ourselves, we used this as a name tag, and we asked if anybody had any idea what these letters stood for. Blank faces, blank faces. And all of a sudden, this one gentleman's eyes began to twinkle, and his mouth began to curve up, and he said, "I know what it stands for. It stands for, I am Lutheran and cuddly." Now, if you don't happen to be Lutheran, you can fit something else in there. But I like that. And you know, to prevent ourselves from either playing the role of the placator or being the victim, we need to remember this, that we're lovable and capable, and that it's okay to say no. Okay, any other questions about this? Placator, blamer, computer, there's two more. There's probably a lot of it. This is bunching, according to Virginia Satir, bunching them into five basics. There's the dictator. And the dictator stands with power. You know, large, huge. Always, oh, excuse me, dictator. I'm dictator. That's that would be under the blamer. The distractor. The distractor is like the clown who's sort of all off and just moving all over places. Always unfocused, usually frantic, can't look you in the eye or answer direct questions, ignores or changes the subject, rarely says meaningful things, but talks a lot. Chatter, chatter, chatter. Inside, they're fearful, don't want to deal with the issue or the feelings surrounding it. An example, what red light? I didn't run through a red light. Did we have an appointment? Did I tell you about changing the subject? And we probably, and sometimes, in some situations, fighting fear may, to be a distractor on some occasions, may help you to fight fear. If you realize that you're just getting too deep into something and you're never going to convince the other person and the other person isn't going to convince you, it may be a time to say, well, I wonder about the price of wheat in Russia right now. Can you change the subject? Can you find some humor? Because you can't be angry and laugh at the same time. Those two emotions just don't mix. So sometimes it might be helpful to be that distractor. But if you're constantly, it's just like the computer person type of communication has its place in getting that information out that's needed. What we want to work toward in our fighting fear is to be the leveler and effective communicator, aware of the four styles and uses them to advantage when it's necessary without taking advantage of somebody else, where it may be helpful. Use logic and reason, doesn't blame anyone else for own feelings, but acknowledges the other person's. Come and join us. Come right up into the front.
Sorry, we're late.
Oh, that's okay.
We're going. You met a very charming person.
You want to come and join on the other side? Could we have you two ladies sort of move together, and then they can come up into this front row in between here and stuff?
Let's move over just.
Come on, there we go. No, you want to come into that one, Jamie? Jamie, there's a chair right there that you can come right into.
We're kind of a communicator in life.
Dictator.
We're just looking. We're looking at, according to Virginia Satir, five communication styles. Placator, having to please, to do everything for everyone. A blamer, never being able to accept responsibility. It's not my fault, it's yours. The computer, who's just very rational, always facts and figures and look, no emotions. The distractor, who just takes off. Now, doesn't want to admit, take responsibility, also changes the subject. The leveler. Aware of these other four styles, and that there are some times when these four styles may be helpful to get you out of a real tight situation. You might just change the subject. You might be very honest and use a good eye message and say, I don't think we're ever going to resolve this together. We've got some very definite opinions. We might just agree to disagree. Soul leveler. Uses logic and reason, does not blame anyone else for their own feelings, but acknowledges the other person's feelings as well. Listens clearly and seeks a common solution. Keeps conversation on topic till settled. So we have to see beyond me if you can. An example of what they might say is, I understand you're upset about that test. How do you think we can improve the situation? Yeah, I guess we have some different opinions about whether we ought to stand or sit to sing the hymns. Maybe that's not something we're going to convince each other of. At some time in our lives, all of us have communicated by using each of the four styles. Some styles much more frequently than others. But learning to communicate as a leveler is a skill that must be developed to be effective. To just take responsibility for what happens. You might look very quickly at some communication roadblocks, because this is often what comes into the problem that causes dirty fighting. We can stereotype or label. We can overgeneralize. And especially if you use the words "you never" or "you always." Is there anything that you ever always do? Never make an exception? Never, ever? Or is there something you never do? And there's never an exception to it. There's bound to be some things that 90, maybe even 99% of the time, but there's bound to be some exception. So to use the words "always" and "never" is a little bit overkill. It's beyond. Interpreting incorrectly, how do we get at the real issue as well? Unless we can check back and say, well, it sounds like you're really upset because I came 15 minutes late and I promised to be on time. And the other person says, no, it's not really the lateness. I just had a telephone call and they said they saw you standing and having a beer with so-and-so, or having an ice cream cone, or having, or just playing around, looking at the windows and not hurrying. And, you know, I can understand sometimes people being late, but when you intentionally plan to be late, so there may be some incorrect interpretation. Tunnel vision. Very little in life is all black or all white. You need to see the gray areas. Are there any exceptions? Do your kids always go to bed at 8 o'clock? Do you always go to bed at 11 o'clock? And if it's 11:05, is your day shot, or your next day going to be shot because some changes? It's hard to make some changes. Being opinionated, having all the answers before all the facts are in. And we often run into this problem with listening. And that somebody's going to tell us a problem, and we start to solve it for them once we hear the first sentence or two. Now, they've been working and dealing with this problem for a long while, and we think we've got the solution in 27 seconds of information.
Dr. Lore, is that her name? is that the right name? You know, this syndicated psychologist who people have these, you know, horrendous problems, and they call in 3 seconds she's, you know, giving all the answers to their lifelong problem.
This is a telephone or a TV call.
It is a telephone thing, sure.
Yeah, it's like listening to Fraser, the TV show. Gossiping, don't repeat as facts unless you know it's the truth, but we do that all of the time. We hear a little bit and we take it to, did you hear? And you know, have you ever played the game of telephone when you were kids, or even as adults? You start out making a statement that this to you, I make a statement to you, and you pass it on, and you pass on what you hear. You don't ask a question back. And by the time it comes around to you, you repeat it back to me, and it has no relationship to what it started out, because each one hears something different, interprets it something different. Sending double messages. I don't care. And then if there's communication where the words, I don't care, mean, well, maybe it's not really a big deal, but then there's the body language and the tone of voice that says, and if you don't think I really care, are you off the mark? Drowning the meaning in a verbal barrage, talking so much that the message is lost. How do we condense into fewer words so that we don't turn the other person off? Complaining, whining, nagging, it's an automatic shut off. Not listening or appearing not to listen by not giving full attention verbally and non-verbally. All of these are things that are sort of dirty pool or dirty fighting. I've added a few more that come from Tom Gordon's effectiveness training materials, and he talks about the dirty dozen. Some of the others were included in the front. But this ordering, directing, commanding, you do it now, and it's probably got the finger out there too, or it's got the hands on the hip and the booming voice, the information that you get through the tone quality and the body language. There may be times, now any of these that we're looking at now, there may be times some of them may be needed. Or shut the door quickly, the baby's heading toward the door, or it's cold outside, or there's flies coming in. There's that sense. But when your response to another person is often, you do this or else. You do it because I said so. I must admit, I personally do not like to see the buttons or sweatshirts that say, I'm the mom or dad, that's why. Mm-hmm. You know, you just fill in the blanks, you do it or else. Or because I'm the mom or dad. I think there's always reasons, there are always better reasons that will give information to the person we're trying to teach something to, than the because, or that's why, without any more. That we can give that, and without having to get caught into a long, sometimes kids will hook us into, but why, and you can begin to cut it off, but to give them a basic reason. It costs too much money, or because I think there are a lot of dangerous possibilities for people to get hurt, not because I said so. And I think they need to know the bottom line. Because I love you is even more helpful than because I said so. And when we use power to coerce people to do things for us, then particularly with kids or with our coworkers, if we're in a supervisory position, we're teaching them how to use power in someone else. And then we're not going to be happy when they use power back in us. So it might be better to give the reasons and not teach power issues. Threatening, blaming, preaching. We've got preachers around here. You know, there's a different sense of preaching, which is overkill on words. And my daughters used to always complain that was one of my roadblocks. Mother, say it in fewer words. This is overkill. You've said too much. And so I had to learn less is more. And I remember one time, when our second daughter was at university, she was talking about a new friend that she started going with, and she said, Mother, you'll like him. He tells long stories. I met him, I did like him. advising, giving solutions. You know, there are times when we do need to get help, give out advice, but, you know, do we really know enough of the information? And, okay, if we know an answer, and we can feel good about the answer, is there any way that we can help the other person to feel good also by letting them discover that answer? You know, help them through, and we'll go through a couple of things on how to look at the problem. Judging, criticizing, disagreeing. How many of you really like to be judged or criticized? I mean, does that make your day shine? You feel, boy, I got criticized 3 times today. That means I'm really good. No, it doesn't. It just sort of tears away at this IALAC sign of yours. It tears off big pieces. And there are other ways of getting the information across rather than judging or criticizing. And we even have directives from our Lord not to be judges. Name-calling, ridiculing, shaming. I don't think a lot of these that we're talking about now have any place in a relationship. Name-calling that's negative, that's put down, that's hurtful. Ridiculing, shaming. And I remember when I grew up as a kid, you know, this, you remember all this, you know, nobody may have said a word, but they go, roll their eyes and shake their head, and you'd feel like less than dust. I don't think we learn our best by being embarrassed, ridiculed, or criticized. I think there are other ways to get that information across more positively that keeps my feeling about myself and my feeling about you up there rather than down here. Analyzing, diagnosing, like psychoanalyzing. Well, the reason you're probably upset about that is because your grandmother did such and such, or your mother, or whatever. Interpreting, questioning. There's nothing, interrogating. There's nothing wrong about questions until they get to be too much. Why'd you do that? What happened? What went on? What was wrong with you? Why did you ever think about that? I mean, you know, most often, the person who's questioning doesn't even give you a chance to answer anything in between. Just goes on and on and on, and you get to, you turn off. Withdraw, distract, humor, divert. There may be times, but there are times when that may not be the appropriate place to do it. And then the silent treatment. And a kind of hurt look. Back to the martyr again. Now, when we look at communication roadblocks, we look at that, you know, if we can find a way to take ownership of whatever we're feeling, what needs to be done, the rule is, I thought we agreed to, I'm confused about. So if we start to use something about what we call I messages, we could reduce a great number of the fights that we come into. And part of what's important is to recognize that no one can make me feel anything I choose not to feel. Now, there's a lot of triggers out there, and there's a lot of things I get triggered on, or somebody can push my button and I'll respond, and kind of automatic, as if I'm a puppet, somebody's got a hold of my strings. But no one has your strings, and no one has a remote control to your feelings to say, zap, 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 now you feel this, and you feel this, and you feel this. But we often give that power to somebody else. And I may, you know, somebody else can tell me, oh, you're full of beans, and I can laugh with them. Somebody else tells me, you're full of beans, with a different kind of tone to it, and I'll dissolve. I've given that person more power than I've given the other person over my feelings. It's not that they can make me, it's I've chosen. That's probably one of the best kept secrets that we don't want to have to take responsibility for our feelings. We want to be able to blame somebody else, to judge somebody else for it. So you can't make me, he, she, or it can't make me, unless they put a bullet through, I mean, a gun to my head or something. There are some exceptions to this. Remember I said there's nothing that's ever, always, and never? But it's more helpful to be able to say, I feel. I'm feeling angry. My emotions are getting ready to blow off the roof. I'm owning that. I'm taking responsibility for my feelings. So we need to own our own feelings and recognize that all feelings are okay. They're not right or wrong feelings. They're not even helpful or unhelpful feelings. It may be very appropriate for you to be outraged and angry at something that's very unjust and unfair and hurtful. It may be very appropriate for you to be sad when you've lost something. It's not just right to be happy. It may be very inappropriate to be happy. You remember a long time ago, Mary Tyler Moore show, she was going with Chuckles the Clown, and Chuckles got killed, and they were at a memorial service for Chuckles, and everybody was in black, and the preacher was eulogizing in a very monotone and very dull, and all of a sudden Mary starts to chuckle. Everybody looks around her, she straightens up and says, and a little bit later she starts to laugh again, and everybody, she does this a couple of times, and everybody's wondering, what's going on? And finally, the minister says, you're right. Chuckles, purpose in life was to make people happy, and I'm looking at all the sad. We really ought to be able to share some of the things that he's done that have enriched our lives, and the whole thing turned and they all laughed. I mean, they all began to remember these pleasant things about Chuckles the Clown, and everybody was laughing. I mean, but at first that seemed like a very inappropriate thing to do. And in other situations it might be not helpful. But all feelings are okay. It's how we respond to them that's judged or criticized. I might be very angry at this, something that's very unjust, and I can try to find a way to change the injustice, to give some support to a person who's being unfairly treated. My actions might be helpful. If I ignore it, or if I go make it worse, or if I get in a fight and throw things, you know, I might get an assault charge. So it's actions, not feelings, that are judged. So we have choices on how we act in our feelings. And that we can look at these choices with what we call an I message. And I think that's very helpful as our beginning part of fighting fair. And it's the difference between I versus you messages. Use, if I say, you're acting stupid. Well, what are you doing that I label stupid? You are so dumb and ignorant and incompetent. Well, what was the action that I based that judgment on? I might find our relationship might be more positive, and it might be better for correcting whatever is not helpful if I were to say, when I see errors made in the spelling on this paper that has to go out, and my words turned all around, so it means the opposite of what I intended it to mean. I'm very embarrassed to see something like this going out. So I can describe what I see, what I'm going to feel about it, and what I need to have done. I need to have you go back to my original letter and type it the way I instructed you to. I haven't done anything to with sarcasm, ridicule, or embarrassment to put down the person who did it. I'm talking about what I need to have done. So instead of getting a new message that puts another person down, I can use something that describes both what I see as the problem, what I feel, what might the reason be, the because, and then I would like, or I need, it would be helpful. This might, or maybe it's we need to work on some problem solving to figure it out. So new messages are often put down, stop, you shouldn't, you don't, you ever, if you don't, you're being naughty, you should know better. And compare the reaction when you use with what's the matter with you today, too snooty to answer when you're spoken to. Compare it with when you don't answer me or look up as I talk, I feel hurt because I think I'm being ignored. So we want to find a way to describe what's happened. There's a description, your feelings, the actual effects on you, and what you need. And we want it, and this is part of an important part of fighting fear, because we want to be able to give that information to the other person so that it's understood and it's clear. No accusations, no blamings, no solutions, and to encourage the other to send the messages as well. And I should say quickly, there's really five different types of I messages. Now, when I do an effectiveness training program or communications program, we do this in 30 hours and not one. There's a declarative I that just says what I believe in, what I feel. I have difficulty with sarcastic people. Yeah, that's making sense. I find it uncomfortable to sit in a room when somebody is smoking. It's a declaring something by feeling. I'm not putting anyone else down. Responsive. somebody asks me a question, I respond by I've decided or I've chosen. It's not helpful to say, I can't, because they're going to try to talk you out of it. But if you say, can be more assertive on it, I've decided or I've chosen not to. Preventive, let the other person know ahead of time what's going to be needed. A positive, that's just a warm fuzzy that says, hey, I like what you did. And rather than saying, you're such a great person, to be able to say, I've enjoyed our conversations. I like being around you. What is it that I like about the other person? Be clear. Give them a nice warm fuzzy, a pat on the back, with words as well. A confrontive is the I message, when I see, I feel, because, and I need. See, we've got just 7 or 8 minutes left. So if we look at fighting fear, here's some basic principles to look at. We want to begin recognizing that I'm not out to beat you. I'm not out to be the winner and make you the loser. Because that's not helpful in relationships. We want to find a no-lose solution, something you can accept, something that I can accept. Particularly if we're working with kids, if we want something to be carried out without having them learning how to use power against me, we have to do some work on finding something that will work, a solution that will work for both of us. So, first of all, we want to know that I'm not going to just try to beat you out. Clarify the issues. What's information that's facts and what's the emotions I'm feeling? I see the facts, you know, what's the actual thing that's visible that you've just heard? Clear it. Isolate the issues. Now we can often find there's 10 and we did this and on this and on this and on this. Which are we going to work on right now? What's the main issue? Right now, the issue is going to be, I need to have you home on time. Or I need to make sure that the car is going to be available for me to leave at 7 because I have to be somewhere at 7:15. And I'm not leaving any leeway. So, you know, how can we manage to get to the several places we have to get with one car? Isolate the issues. Value the differences. And what's important is that what's underlined, value the person. That, you know, I think we really both want the best. We both want to solve this. Don't say, well, I'm willing to solve it, but I know you're going to be an old stick in the mud. Or I know you just want to keep control, my way or the highway. Well, you know, how do we help value the person? How do we build on commonality? What can we agree on? Well, you know, we've got this, and we've got this, and this. Sometimes if you look at the positives, we're always so much more ready to look at the negatives. Well, you didn't do this, and they shouldn't, yeah, this hasn't happened, and because, rather than, well, I see this has started, and we've got this going for us, now how can we work with these other things that are still sitting there, causing a problem? Own your own feelings, back to that again. All feelings are acceptable. Behavior actions are judged. Work for agreements that are tolerable. Build on what we can agree to. What do we all want? Agreement of wants, of concerns, and of desires. And then assume the need to give and take. Okay, if you're willing to give on this, I'm willing to give on this. If there is some movement, you're still going to be realistic. How are we going to get this to work out? So one of the other things that helps when we're looking at something that's happened that's going to build for a fight that's got a problem that we want to solve, and that's to look at these 5 important parts. The first is to, in the processing of experience, the first part is to acknowledge the feelings. And we can do that. A couple of days ago I did a session on being able to identify feelings and to do some active listening, reflective listening, paraphrasing. Identify what you hope we can come up, I hope we can solve this problem about how we're going to both be able to use the car. Hope we can find, you know, find a solution. That's the bottom line. To analyze, give meaning. Do not say, well, why did you do it? If you say why, what are some general responses that you're going to get? Teens learn it very well, and it goes on through much of adult life, that, you know, it's because, I don't know. Or just a shrug of the shoulders. Nothing said, just, they're not even going to bother wasting words. So don't even bother wasting your words and asking the question why. You can rephrase the question in a different manner. What did you hope would happen? Not what was going on in your pea-picking mind when you did that. I mean, that's a kind of degrading statement. Did you have an idea of what you wanted to have happen? How did you decide to do what you decided to do? What did you really want to have happen? Generalize what learned. Well, remember the last time when we had this problem solving, you could say, can you go back to something that really worked? Can you generalize? Remember, we were able to work through this before. Let's see how we can work through this now. That there's going to be something that we can move one learning into another situation. And these last parts, I think, are very helpful. If you make a plan, what if you find that you just can't do this? Well, maybe we can come back and talk about it again. What will you do? What will I do? Well, I intend to do such and such. How do you see your part in this? Often we come up with a solution to a problem and we just leave, and nobody has taken direct responsibility for one thing or another, and nothing ever happens. And I thought we worked through it. Look at all the time we spent. And then you can get even more emotional about it because you promised. Well, what did I promise? I don't remember promising anything. Well, you said, well, okay, then make a plan. And what do you, sometimes maybe even write it out. What are some options? What are some possibilities as to how you might be able to do this? If this happens, then what? If something else happens, then what? So we look at some of the consequences. That there's consequences to all of our actions. Is this going to be helpful or not helpful? Not right or wrong, good or bad. Is it going to be helpful or not helpful? Because sometimes we begin to be labeled by what the consequences are. If that turned out bad, I'm bad. And we want to look at the action, not the person. You can label the thing, but don't label the person. Because those labels stick too often when we don't want them. How will you decide? What else will you need to know? What else do we need to know to get this? How do we come back then and evaluate what we've actually done? Did it work out? Are you happy? Do we need to make some changes? So that we can fight fair. And I think a couple of things that are very helpful to remember is, as we sort of pull things together here, don't ever give up. See what the frog is doing? But I think even more important, where did I do my last? You know, just in fighting fair, maybe even in communicating fair. Let me close with this little story from Irma Bondyk. Do you know who Irma Bondyk is? Marvelous, dealing with life kind of person. She has a way with words. She says, on TV the other day, a leading child psychologist said parents should treat their children as they would treat their best friend, with courtesy, dignity, diplomacy, even in fighting, with courtesy, dignity, diplomacy. She said, I never treated my children any other way, I told myself, but later that night I thought about it. Did I really talk to my best friends like I talk to my children? We could substitute partner in there too. Just suppose our good friends Fred and Eleanor came to dinner one night and, well, it's about time you two got here. What have you been doing, dawdling? Now leave those shoes outside, Fred. They've got mud on them. And shut the door. Were you born in a barn? So, Eleanor, how have you been? I've been meaning to have you over for such a long time. Fred, take it easy on that chip dip or you'll ruin your dinner, and I didn't slave over a hot stove all day to have you nibble like some bird. Heard from any of the gang lately? Got a card for the Martins. Yes, they're in Lauderdale again. They go every year to the same spot. What's the matter with you, Fred? You're fidgeting. Of course you have to go. Look at all the punch you've just drunk. It's down the hall, first door on the left, and I don't want to see a towel in the middle of the floor when you've finished, and flush. Did you wash your face before you came, Eleanor? You see a dark spot around your mouth. Oh, I guess it's a shadow. So how are the children? If you ask me, I think summer school is great for them. Now, is everybody hungry? Then why don't we go into dinner? You all go wash up, and I'll take up the food. Don't tell me your hands are clean, Eleanor. I saw you playing with the dog. Fred, you sit over there, and Eleanor, you can sit with that half glass of milk. You know how you're all elbows when it comes to milk. Now there, your host will say grace. Fred, I don't see any cauliflower on your plate. Have you tried it? Well, try a spoonful. If you don't like it, I won't make you finish it. But if you don't try it, you can just forget dessert. And sit up straight or your spine will grow that way. Now, what were we talking about? Oh, yes, the Gerbers. They sold their house. I hear they took a beating. But, Eleanor, don't talk with food in your mouth. I can't understand a word you're saying, and use your napkin. At that moment in my fantasy, my son walked into the room. How nice of you to come, I said pleasantly. Now what did I do? Communication has a great influence on fighting, and I hope we become a little bit more sensitive in what we're saying and how we deal with those that are near and dear to us. Any comments or questions?